Side 9, The Hidden City, The Tomilee, Book 3, by David Eddings, continuing on page 299.
"You're even starting to sound like Sophronia, Annaray," Sparhawk said with a faint smile. "What are we overlooking?"
"Robes of any shade or hue will serve, Annika," she explained patiently, "and doubtless may be obtained in Vigayo, close by yon oasis."
"They have to be black, Annaray," Bevier objected.
"Color is an aspect of light, Sir Bevier, and I am most skilled at controlling light."
"Oh," he said, "I guess I didn't think of that."
"I had noticed that myself, almost immediately."
"Be nice," he murmured.
Bergston's knights and their Paloi allies crossed the Senescan border on a cloudy, chill afternoon, after what seemed to be several days of hard riding, and headed southeasterly toward the capital at Sinestra. Paloi scouts ranged out in front, but they encountered no resistance that day. They made camp, put out guards, and bedded down early. It was not long after they had broken camp and set out on what was ostensibly the next morning that Daya came riding back to join Bergston and Heldon at the head of the column.
"My scouts report that there are soldiers massing about a mile ahead, Your Reverence," he reported.
"Seniskans?" Bergston asked quickly.
"It does not appear so, Your Reverence."
"Go have a look, Heldon," Bergston ordered.
The Pandian nodded and spurred his horse to the top of a rocky hill a quarter mile to the front. His face was bleak when he returned.
"We've got trouble, Your Grace," he rumbled. "There are more of those monsters we came up against in eastern Zemok."
Bergston muttered a fairly savage oath.
"I knew things were going too well."
"Domi Takumi has warned us about these foreign soldiers," Daya said. "Would it offend Your Reverence if I suggested that you let us deal with them? Domi Takumi and Domi Kring have devised certain tactics that seem to work."
"I'm not offended in the slightest, friend Daya," Bergston replied. "We didn't exactly cover ourselves with glory the last time we encountered those brutes, so I'd be very interested in seeing something that's a little more effective than our tactics were."
Daya conferred briefly with his clan chief, and then he led Bergston, Heldon, and several other knights up to the top of the hill to watch. Bergston immediately saw the advantages of light cavalry as opposed to armored knights mounted on heavy war horses. The huge soldiers in their tight-fitting armor seemed baffled by the slashing attacks of the Paloi armed with javelins. They floundered forward, desperately trying to close with their tormentors, but the cat-footed horses of the Paloi were simply too quick. The javelins began to take their toll, and more of the hulking monsters fell in that deadly rain.
"The idea is to force them to run, Your Reverence," Daya explained. "They're very dangerous in close quarters, but they don't seem to have much endurance, so they aren't nearly as much a threat in a running fight."
"Vanyan told me about that," Bergston said. "Did Domi Takumi give you any idea of how long it takes them to run out of breath?"
"Nothing very specific, Your Reverence."
Bergston shrugged.
"That's all right, friend Daya. We've got plenty of open ground, and it's still morning. We can run them all day if we have to."
Stung by the repeated attacks, the huge soldiers began to lumber forward in a kind of shuffling trot, brandishing their horrid weapons and bellowing hoarse war cries. The Paloi, however, refused those challenges and continued their slash-and-run tactics. Then, driven and stung beyond endurance, the creatures broke into a shambling run.
"It's feasible," Sir Heldon mused in his deep, rumbling basso. "We'd need different equipment, though."
"What are you talking about, Heldon?"
Bergston demanded.
"Looking to the future, Your Grace," Heldon replied. "If those beasts become a standard fixture, we'll have to modify a few things. It might not be a bad idea to train and equip a few squadrons of church knights to serve as light cavalry."
"Heldon," Bergston said acidly, "if those things become a standard fixture, it'll be because we've lost this war. What makes you think there'll be any church knights at that point?"
"They're breaking off, Your Reverence," Daya cried excitedly. "They're running away."
"But where are they running to, Daya?" Bergston demanded. "It's the air that's killing them, and the air's everywhere. Where can they go, Daya? Where can they go?
Where can they go? Kring asked in bafflement, as Klel's soldiers broke off from their clumsy pursuit of the Poloi horsemen and fled into the desert.
Who cares? Takumi laughed. Let them run. We've still got those seer guy penned up in that gully. We'd better get them to moving before some clever subaltern in the rear ranks has time to take his bearings.
The seer guy were following a strategy from the dawn of time. They advanced steadily, marching in step with their large round shields protecting their bodies and with their long spears leveled to the front. As the Poloi slashed in on them, they would stop and close ranks. The front rank would kneel with overlapping shields and leveled spears. The ranks behind would close up, their shields also overlapping, and spears also to the front. It was absolutely beautiful, but it didn't accomplish anything at all against cavalry.
We have to get them to run, Domi Takumi,
Kring shouted to his friend as they galloped clear of the massed Seergai regiments again.
Pull your children back a little farther after the next attack. This won't work if those antiques just keep plotting. Make them run.
Takumi shouted some orders, and his horsemen altered their tactics, pulling back several hundred yards and forcing the seer guy to come to them. A brazen trumpet sounded from the center of one of the advancing regimental squares, and the seer guy broke into a jingling trot, their ranks still perfectly straight.
They look good, don't they? Takumi laughed. They would if this was a parade ground,
Kring replied.
Let's sting them again and then pull back even farther. How far is it to the border? Takumi asked. Who knows? Nobody I've talked with is really sure. We're close, though. Make them run, Takumi. Make them run.
Takumi rose in his stirrups.
Pass the word, he bellowed. Full retreat.
The Poloi turned tail and galloped to the east across the rattling brown gravel. A thin cheer went up from the massed regiments of the Seergai, and the trumpet sounded again. The ancient soldiers, still in perfect step and with their ranks still perfectly straight, broke into a running charge. Sergeants barked the staccato cadence, and the sound of the half-boots of the Seergai beating on the barren ground was like the pounding of some huge drum. And then the full light of a winter midday dimmed, as if some giant silent wings had somehow blotted out the sun. A chill wind swept across the desert, and there was a wailing sound like the sum of human woe. The suddenly stricken seer guy, rank upon rank, died soundlessly in mid-stride, falling limply to earth to be trampled by their blindly advancing comrades, who also fell astonished on top of them. Kring and Takumi, both pale and trembling, watched in awestruck wonder as the ancient spirit curse did its dreadful work. Then, sickened, they wheeled and rode back eastward, turning their backs on the heaped reminder of those perfect soldiers rushing blindly into chill, wailing obliteration.
These clothes are good enough for Arjuna and Tommel proper, neighbor,
Sparhawk told the shopkeeper later that same day.
But they don't exactly turn the trick in a dust storm. I think that last one put about 4 pounds of dirt down my back.
The shopkeeper nodded sagely.
Other races laugh at our customary garb, good master, he observed. They usually keep laughing right up until the time when they ride through their first dust storm.
Does the wind blow all the time out there? Talon asked him.
Not quite all the time, young master. The afternoons are usually the worst.
He looked at Sparhawk.
How many robes will you be needing, good master?
There are 6 of us, neighbor, and none of us are so fond of each other that we'd care to share a robe.
Have you any preference in colors?
Does one color keep the dust out better than the others?
Not that I've noticed.
Then any color will do, I guess.
The shopkeeper hustled into his storeroom and returned with a pile of neatly folded garments. Then he smiled, rubbed his hands together, and broached the subject of the price. He overcharged you, you know, Talon said as they emerged from the cluttered shop into the dusty street. Sparhawk shrugged.
Perhaps, he said.
Someday I'm going to have to teach you about the finer points of haggling.
Does it really matter? Sparhawk asked.
tying the bundle of Senescan robes to the back of his saddle. He looked around. Anaray?
I am here, Annika, her whispered voice responded.
Were you able to find anything?
Nay, Annika, clearly the messenger hath not yet arrived.
Beret and Halad are still several days away, Sparhawk, Talon said quietly, and this isn't such an attractive place that the messenger would want to get here early to enjoy the scenery. He looked around at the winter-dispirited palm trees and the muddy pond that lay at the center of the cluster of white houses. Attractive or not, we're going to have to come up with some reason for staying, Sparhawk said. We can't leave until the messenger gets here and Anaray Zanisha can listen to what he's thinking.
I can remain here alone, Annika, Zanisha told him. None here can detect my presence, so I do not need protection.
We'll stay all the same, Anaray, Sparhawk told her. Courtesy and all that, you understand. And a lean gentleman will not permit a lady to go about unescorted.
An argument had broken out on the shaded porch of what appeared to be a tavern or a wine shop of some kind.
You don't know what you're talking about, Ekon,
a wheezy-voiced old man in a patched and filthy robe declared loudly.
It's a good 100 miles from here to the River Sarna, and there's no water at all between here and there.
You either drink too much, or you've been out in the sun too long, Zagori.
Ekon, a thin, sun-dried man in a dark blue robe, scoffed.
My map says that it's 60 miles, no more. How well do you know the man who drew the map? I've been here all my life, and I know how far it is to the Sarna. Go ahead, though. Take only enough water for 60 miles. Your mules will die, and you'll be drinking sand for that last 40 miles. It's all right with me, though, because I've never liked you all that much anyway. But mark my words, Ekon. It's 100 miles from the well of the guy there to the banks of the Sarna.
And the old man spat in the direction of the pale brown pond. Talon suddenly began to laugh.
What's so funny? Sparhawk asked him.
We just had a stroke of luck, revered leader, the boy replied gaily.
If we're all finished up here, why don't we go back to where the others are waiting? We'll all want to get a good night's sleep, since we'll probably be leaving first thing in the morning.
Oh? For where?
Sirga, of course. Wasn't that where we wanted to go?
Yes, but we don't know where Sirga is.
That's where you're wrong, Sparhawk. We do know the way to Sirga. At least, I do.
Chapter 23
Did he die well?
Betwana asked. Her face was very pale, but she gave no other outward sign of distress.
It was a suitable death, Betwana Queen, the messenger replied. We were at the bottom of a gorge, and the Quell Beast was hurling the sides of it down upon us. Andril King attacked the beast, and many escaped that would have died if he had not. She considered it.
Yes,
she agreed finally. It was suitable. It will be remembered. Is the army fit to travel? We have many injured, Betwana Queen, and thousands are buried in the gorge. You withdrew to Tualas to await your commands. Leave some few to care for the injured, and bring the army here, she told him. Tosa is no longer in danger. The danger is here. It shall be as you say, my queen.
He clashed his fist against his breastplate in salute. The Queen of Aton rose to her feet, her still pale face betraying no emotion.
I must go apart and consider this, Itanya Ambassador, she said formally.
It is proper, Betwana Queen, he responded. I share your grief.
But not my guilt.
She turned and slowly left the room. Itanya looked at the stony-faced Engessa.
I'd better pass the word to the others, he said.
Engessa nodded shortly.
Could you speak with a messenger before he leaves, Engessa? Itanya asked. Lord Vanyan will need casualty figures before he can change his strategy.
I will obtain them for you, Itanya Ambassador.
Engessa inclined his head shortly and went out. Itanya swore and banged his fist on the table.
Of all the times for this to happen, he fumed, if that idiot had only waited before he got himself killed.
Betwana had done nothing wrong. There had been no stain of dishonor in her concern for Engessa, and if she had only had a week or two to put it behind her,
it would probably have been forgotten, along with the personal feelings which caused it. But Amsel's death, coming as it did at this particular time, Itania swore again. The Aton Queen had to be able to function, and this crisis might well incapacitate her. For all Itania knew, she was in her room right now preparing to fall on her sword. He rose and went looking for paper and pen. Vanyan had to be warned about this before everything here in Sarna flew apart. It all fell into place when I heard that old man call their little pond the Well of the Guy, Talon explained. Ugarajan used exactly the same term.
I don't know that it means very much, Mirtai said dubiously. Seneskans call all these desert springs wells. The guy was probably the one who discovered it.
But the important thing is that this is one of the landmarks Ugarajan mentioned, Sevier said. How did the subject come up? He asked Talon.
Stragan and I were spinning moonbeams for Valish, the boy replied. Ugarajan had just arrived from Varel, and he was sitting in a chair with his brains quietly rotting. Stragan was telling Valish about something he'd supposedly overheard, some fellow telling another that Scarfa was waiting for instructions from Sirga. He was fishing for information, and he casually asked Valish what route a man would have to follow to get to Sirga. That's when Ugarajan jumped in. He started rambling about the Well of the Guy and the Plains of Salt and other places with names that sounded as if they'd come right out of a storybook. I thought he was just raving, but Valish got really excited and tried to hush him up. That's what made me pay attention. I got the feeling that Ugarajan was giving Stragan very specific directions to Sirga, but that the directions were all clouded over with those storybook names. This Well of the Guy business makes me start to wonder if the directions were as cloudy and garbled as I thought they were right at first.
What were his exact words, young Talon? Zenisha asked.
He said, the pathway lies close by the Well of the Guy. That's when Valish tried to shut him up, but he kept right on. He said something about wanting to give Stragan directions so that he could go to Sirga and bow down to Sirgon. He told him to go northwest from the Well of the Guy to the Forbidden Mountains.
Sparhawk checked over his map.
There are several clusters of mountains in central Seneska, and that's the general region Afriel pointed out back on the island. What else did he say, Talon?
He sort of jumped around. He talked about the Forbidden Mountains and the Pillars of Sirgon. Then he doubled back on himself and started talking about the Plains of Salt. From what he told Stragan, you're supposed to be able to see these Forbidden Mountains from those salt plains. Then there was something about fiery white pillars and the plain of bones. He said that the bones are the nameless slaves who toil until death for Sirgon's chosen. Evidently, when a slave dies in Sirga, he's taken out and dumped in the desert. That boneyard wouldn't be very far from the city then, Carlton mused.
It does all sort of fit together, Sparhawk, Sevier said seriously. The Seneskans themselves are largely nomads, so they wouldn't have any real need for large numbers of slaves. Ugarajan spoke of Sirgon's chosen. That would be the Sirgai, and they're probably the ones who buy slaves.
And that would mean that the caravan of slavers we saw is going to Sirga, wouldn't it? Talon added excitedly.
And they were going northwest, Mirtai said, the exact direction Ugarajan was raving about.
Sparhawk went to his saddlebags and took out his map. He sat down again and opened it, holding it firmly as the desert wind started to flap its corners.
We know that Sirga's somewhere in these mountains in central Seneska, he mused, so we'll be going in that direction anyway. If Ugarajan was just raving and his directions don't go any place, we'll still be in the right vicinity if we follow them. It's better than just sitting here waiting for Barret and Khalad, Carlton said impatiently. I have to be doing something, even if it's only riding around in circles out there in the desert.
Sparhawk wordlessly put a comforting hand on his old friend's shoulder. His own desperate concern was at least as driving as Carlton's, but he knew that he had to keep it separate, remote. Desperate men make mistakes, and a mistake here could put Elana in even greater peril. His emotions screamed at him, but he grimly, implacably pushed them into a separate compartment of his mind and firmly closed the door.
Annika would be made glad if we would do this, Lop said in Trollish to the enormous presences.
Gorg, god of Kill, rumbled ominously.
Annika's thought is like the wind, he complained. One time he said to us, go to the place the man things call the Tommel Mountains to kill the children of Sirgon. Now he says to us, go to the place the man things call Jubei to kill the children of Sirgon. Can he not decide which children of Sirgon he wants us to kill?
It is the way of the hunt, Gorg, Tinian explained. The children of Sirgon are not like the red deer, which feed always in the same range. The children of Sirgon are like the reindeer, which go from this place to that place, as the seasons change, to find better food. Before, they were going to this place, Tommel Mountain, to feed. But now they go to the place Jubei to feed. If we hunt in the Tommel Mountains, we will find no game to kill and eat.
It speaks well, Gnome Godavit said. It is not Annika's thought which changes. It is the path of the creatures we hunt which changes. The way of the hunt tells us that we must go where they graze if we would find them and kill them and eat them. This hunt becomes more and more not simple, Gord grumbled. That is because the man-things are more not simple than the deer-things,
Quaj, god of fire, told him.
The thought of Tinian from Deera is good. The one who hunts where there is no game does not eat.
Gorg pondered it.
We must follow the way of the hunt, he decided. We will take our children to the place Jubei to hunt the children of Sirgon. When they come there to graze, our children will kill them and eat them.
It would make us glad if you would, Tinian said politely.
I will take our children into the time which does not move, Gnome said. They will be in the place Jubei before the children of Sirgon come there.
Shlee, god of ice, stuck his huge fingers into the dirt. The earth shuddered slightly and contorted itself into his picture of the continent.
Show us where, Ulath from Felicia, he said. Where is the place Jubei?
Ulath walked some distance along the southwestern edge of the tiny mountains of Aton, peering intently at the ground. Then he stopped, bent, and touched a spot a short way out into the northern end of the desert of Seneska.
It is here, Shlee, he said.
Gorg, god of Kill, stood up.
We will take our children there, he declared. Let us make Annika glad.
They're watching us, Vanyan, Sophronia said quietly.
He pulled his horse in closer to hers. Styrix? He asked quietly.
One of them is, she replied. He's not particularly skilled.
She smiled faintly.
I may have to hit him over the head to get his attention.
Whatever it takes, love, he said.
He glanced back over his shoulder at the column of knights, and then on ahead. They were coming down out of the mountains, and the valley of the Sarna was beginning to broaden.
We should reach that bridge tomorrow, he told her. After we cross the river, we'll be in Seneska.
Yes, dear one, she said. I've seen the map.
Why don't you cast the spell, he suggested. Let's give our inept Styrix out there a chance to earn his keep.
He looked at her gravely.
I'm having some second thoughts about this, Sophronia. Klel's still out there. And if he thinks Sparhawk's somewhere in this column with Bellium, he'll be all over us.
You can't have it both ways, Vanyan, she said with a fond smile. You said that you were never going to let me out of your sight. So if you insist on going into dangerous places, I'm sort of obliged to go along. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'll wake up that Styrix.
She began to speak softly in Styrix, her fingers weaving the spell as she did so. Vanyan was puzzled. He took a certain pride in his familiarity with most of the spells, but this was one he had never seen or heard before. He watched more closely.
Never mind, she told him crisply, breaking off the spell. You don't need to know this one, but just look over there, Vanyan, she said. I can do this without any help.
She paused.
Humor me, dear one. A girl needs a few secrets after all.
He smiled and turned his head.
There was a kind of vague blurring in the air about 10 yards away. And then, as surely as if he were really there, Vanyan saw Sparhawk appear, mounted as always on his evil-tempered roan. So real was the image that flies were attracted to the horse.
"Brilliant!"
Vanyan exclaimed. He sent out a probing thought, and even encountered the familiar sense of Sparhawk's presence.
"If I didn't know better, I'd swear that he was really here. Can you sustain this illusion?"
"Naturally," she said in an infuriatingly offhand way.
And then she laughed, reached out, and fondly touched his cheek. "What took you so long?" Talon asked the child goddess when she appeared on the edge of their camp outside Vagayo the following morning.
"I've been busy," she replied with a little shrug. "This is a fairly complex business, you know. We all do want to get there at approximately the same time, don't we? What's the problem here, Sparhawk?"
"We might have just had a bit of good luck for a change, Divine One," he replied. "Talon and I were in the village yesterday, and we heard one of the villagers refer to their oasis as the Well of the Guy."
"So?"
"Why don't you tell her about it, Talon?"
The young thief quickly repeated the conversations between Ogorajan and Stragan back in Baressa.
"What do you think?"
Kalton asked the child goddess.
"Does somebody have a map?"
she asked. Sparhawk went to his saddlebags, took out his tightly rolled map, and brought it to her. She spread it out on the ground, knelt in front of it, and studied it for several moments.
"There are some salt flats out there," she conceded.
"And they are in the right direction," Bevier pointed out.
"Ogorajan's been there," Talon added. "At least he says he has, so he'd almost have to know the way, wouldn't he?"
"There's also a slaver's route that runs off to the northwest,"
Nirtai said.
"We saw a caravan following it when we first got here, and Ogorajan mentioned the fact that the Seer guy keeps slaves. It sort of stands to reason that the slave caravan's bound for Sirga, doesn't it?"
"You're hanging all this speculation on the ravings of a madman, you know,"
Flute said critically.
"You said yourself that Sirga's somewhere in central Sineska,"
Kalton reminded her,
"and that's where all of this points. Even if Ogorajan left some things out, we'll still end up in the general vicinity of Sirga. We'll be a lot closer than we are right now, anyway."
"Since you've all made up your minds, why did you bother me with it?"
Her tone was just a bit petulant.
Talon grinned at her. "We didn't think it'd be polite to run off without telling you, Divine One."
"I'll get you for that, Talon," she threatened.
"How far ahead of us would you say that caravan is by now?" Sparhawk asked Nirtai.
10 leagues, she replied. 12 at the most. Slave caravans don't move very fast."
"I think that's our best bet, then," he decided. "Let's put on those black robes and get started. We'll trail along a couple of leagues behind that caravan, and anybody who happens to see us will think we're stragglers." "Anything's better than just sitting still," Kalton said.
"Somehow I was sure you'd feel that way about it," Sparhawk replied.
"We're little more than prisoners here," Empress Chokhol declared, waving her hand at the luxurious furnishings of the women's palace.
Chokhol was a ripe-figured Senescan lady in her 30s. Her tone was one of only idle discontent, but her eyes were hard and shrewd as she looked at Elisun. Elisun shrugged.
"I've never had any trouble coming and going as I choose." "That's because you're a Valesian," Empress Torelia told her with just a touch of resentment. "They make allowances for you they don't make for the rest of us. I don't think it's very fair."
Elisun shrugged again.
"Fair or not, it's the custom. Why should you have more freedom than the rest of us?" "Because I have a more active social life. Aren't there enough men in the women's palace for you?" "Don't be catty, Torelia. You're not old enough to make it convincing."
Elisun looked appraisingly at the Arjunai Empress. Torelia was a slender girl in her mid-20s, and, like all Arjunai women, she was quite subservient. Chokhol was obviously taking advantage of that.
"You don't see anybody restricting Sierona's movements," Chokhol said. "Sierona's the first wife," Elisun replied, "and she's the oldest. We should respect her age, if nothing else." "I will not be a servant to an aging Tamil hag," Chokhol flared.
"She doesn't want you as a servant, Chakol,"
Ella soon told her.
"She already has more servants than she can count, unless Lyatris has thinned them out some more. All Sierona really wants is a fancier crown than the rest of us have, and the right to walk in front of us in formal processions. It doesn't take much to make her happy. She's not the brightest person in Mithurin."
Torellia giggled.
"Here comes Gehenis,"
Chakol hissed. The jug-eared Tegan Empress, covered to the chin in scratchy wool, approached them with a disapproving expression, an expression that came over her face every time she so much as looked at the barely dressed Ellisoon.
"Ladies," she greeted them with a stiff little nod. "Join us, Gehenis," Chakol invited. "We're discussing politics."
Gehenis's bulging eyes brightened. Tegan's lived and breathed politics.
"Chakol and Torellia want to get up a petition to our husband," Ellisoon said. She raised her arms and yawned deeply, stretching back and literally thrusting her bare breasts at Gehenis. Gehenis quickly averted her eyes.
"I'm sorry, ladies," Ellisoon apologized. "I didn't get much sleep last night."
"How do you find enough hours in the day?" Gehenis asked spitefully.
"It's only a matter of scheduling, Gehenis,"
Ellisoon shrugged.
"You can get all sorts of things accomplished if you budget your time. Why don't we just drop it, dear? You don't approve of me, and I don't really care. We'll never understand each other, so why waste our time trying?
You can go anywhere in the Imperial compound you want to, can't you, Ellisoon?"
Chakol asked rather tentatively. Ellisoon feigned another yawn to conceal her smile. Chakol had finally gotten to the point. Ellisoon had wondered how long it was going to take.
"I can come and go more or less as I choose," she replied. "I guess all the spies got tired of trying to keep up with me. Do you suppose I could ask a favor of you?" "Of course, dear. What do you need?"
"Sierona doesn't like me, and her spies follow me everywhere I go. I'm involved in something at the moment I'd rather she didn't find out about."
"Why, Chakol, are you saying that you finally decided to go a little farther afield for entertainment?"
The Senescan Empress gave her a blank stare, obviously missing her point.
"Oh, come now, dear," Ellisoon said slyly. "We all have our little private amusements here inside the women's palace. Even Gehenis here."
"I most certainly do not," the Tegan protested.
"Oh, really, Gehenis? I've seen that new page boy of yours. He's absolutely luscious. Who's your new lover, Chakol? Some husky young lieutenant in the guards? Did you want me to smuggle him into the palace for you?"
"It's nothing like that, Ellisoon."
"Of course it isn't,"
Ellisoon agreed with heavy sarcasm.
"All right, Chakol, I'll carry your love notes for you, if you're really sure you trust me that close to him. But why go so far afield, sister dear? Gehenis has this lovely young page boy, and I'm sure she's trained him very well. Haven't you, Gehenis?"
She raised one mocking eyebrow.
"Tell me, dear," she added, "was he a virgin? Before you got your hands on him, I mean."
Gehenis fled, with Ellisoon's mocking laughter following after her. Chapter 24. "It's supposed to be two words," Kalkin insisted that afternoon, some miles outside Vagayo. "Rams, horn, two words."
"It's a password, Sir Kalkin," Talon tried to explain. "Ram's horn, like that."
"What do you say, Sparhawk?" Kalkin asked his friend. "Is it one word or two?"
The three of them had just finished piling rocks in a rough approximation of a grave at the side of the trail, and Talon and Kalkin were arguing about the crude marker the boy had prepared.
"What difference does it make?" Sparhawk shrugged.
"If it's spelled wrong, Barrett might not recognize it when he rides by," Talon said.
"He'll recognize it," Sparhawk disagreed. "Barrett's quick."
Just don't disturb the arrangement of those yellow rocks on the top of the grave.
Are you sure Khalad will understand what those rocks mean? Talon asked skeptically.
Your father would have, Sparhawk replied, and I'm sure he taught Khalad all the usual signals.
I still say it's supposed to be two words, Kalton insisted.
Bevier, Sparhawk called.
The Serenic Knight walked back to the imitation grave with an inquiring expression.
These two are arguing about how to spell ram's horn, Sparhawk told him. You're the scholar. You settle it.
I say he spelled it wrong, Kalton said truculently. It's supposed to be two words, isn't it?
Ah, Bevier said evasively, there are two schools of thought on that.
Why don't you tell them about it as we ride along? Mirtai suggested.
Sparhawk looked at Zanisha. Don't, he warned her quietly.
What wouldst thou not have me do, Annika?
She asked innocently.
Don't laugh. Don't even smile. You'll only make it worse.
It may or may not have been 3 weeks later. Patriarch Bergston had given up on trying to keep track of actual time. Instead, he glared in sullen theological discontent at the mud-walled city of Sinestra, and at the disgustingly young and well-conditioned person coming toward him. Bergston believed in an orderly world, and violations of order made him nervous. She was very tall, and she had golden skin and night-dark hair. She was also extremely pretty and superbly muscled. She emerged from the main gate of Sinestra under a flag of truce, running easily out to meet them. She stopped some distance to their front, and Bergston, Sir Heldon, Daya, and Marin, their Tamil translator, rode forward to confer with her. She spoke at some length with Marin.
Keep your eyes where they belong, Heldon, Bergston muttered.
I know what you were doing.
Stop it.
Bergston paused.
I wonder why they sent a woman.
Marin, a slender Tamil, who had been sent along by Ambassador Fontan, returned. She's Eitana Maris, he told them, commander of the Eitan garrison here in Sinestra.
A woman?
Bergston was startled. It's not uncommon among the Eitans, Your Grace. She's been expecting us. Foreign Minister Oscania sent word that we were coming.
What's the situation in the city? Heldon asked.
King Jalu has been quietly dribbling troops into Sinestra for the past month or so, Aaron replied. Eitana Maris has 1,000 Eitans in her garrison, and the Sinescans have been trying to restrict their movements. She's been growing impatient with all of that. She probably would have moved against the royal palace a week ago, but Oscania instructed her to wait until we arrived.
How did she get out of the city?
Heldon rumbled. I didn't ask her, Sir Heldon. I didn't want to insult her.
What I meant was, didn't they try to stop her?
They're dead if they did.
But she's a woman, Bergston objected.
You're not really familiar with the Eitans, are you, Your Reverence? Daya asked.
I've heard of them, friend Daya. The stories all seem wildly exaggerated to me.
No, Your Reverence, they aren't. Daya said firmly. I know of this girl's reputation. She's the youngest garrison commander in the entire Eitan army, and she didn't get to where she is by being sweet and ladylike. From what I've heard, she's an absolute savage.
But she's so pretty, Heldon protested.
Sir Heldon, Naren said firmly to him, while you're admiring her, pay particular attention to the development of her arms and shoulders. She's as strong as a bull. And if you offend her in any way at all, she'll tear you to pieces. She almost killed Eitania, or so the rumor has it.
The foreign minister's brother?
Bergston asked. Nera nodded. He was here on a mission, and he decided to place the city under martial law. He needed Eitana Maris's help with that, so he seduced her. Her response was enthusiastic, but very muscular. Be very careful around her, gentlemen. She's almost as dangerous to have as a friend as an enemy. She asked me to give you your instructions.
Instructions? Bergston erupted. I don't take orders from women.
Your Grace, Marin said, Sinestra is technically still under martial law, and that puts Eitana Maris in charge. She's been ordered to deliver the city to you. but she's instructed you to wait outside the walls until she's crushed all the resistance. She wants to present the city to you as a gift, all neat and tidy. Please don't spoil it for her. Smile at her, thank her politely, and wait right here until she's finished cleaning the streets. After she's got all the bodies stacked in neat piles, she'll invite you in and turn the city over to you, along with King Jalua's head, more than likely. I know that the situation seems unnatural to you, but for God's sake, don't do anything to offend her. She'll go to war with you just as quickly as with anybody else.
But she's so pretty, Haldin objected again.
Barret and Khalad dismounted and led their horses down to the oasis to water them. In theory, they might have reached Vagayo this soon.
Can you tell if he's here?
Khalad muttered. Barret shook his head. I think that means that he's not hysteric. We'll just have to wait for him to come to us. He looked around at the few white-walled houses shaded by low palm trees. Is there any kind of inn here?
Not very likely. I see a lot of tents on the other side of the oasis. I'll ask around, but don't get your hopes up.
Barret shrugged. Oh, well, we've lived in tents before. Find out where we're permitted to set up. The village of Vagayo itself was clustered along the eastern side of the oasis, and the informal encampment of nomads and merchants stretched along the west shore of what was actually a fair-sized pool of artesian water. Barret and Khalad picketed their horses, erected their tent near the water, and sat down in the shade to wait.
Can you tell if Sparhawk's around any place?
Khalad asked. Barret shook his head. He may have already passed through, or he could be watching from one of the hills outside of town. He might not want people to know that he's here. It was an hour or so past sunset, and twilight was descending when a Seneskin in a loose-fitting striped robe approached their tent. I'm supposed to ask if one of you might be named Sparhawk, he said in a slightly accented voice. Barret rose to his feet. I might be named Sparhawk, neighbor. Might be. That's the way you phrased your question, friend. You've got a note for me. Why don't you just hand it over and be on your way? We don't really have anything else to talk about, do we? The messenger's face hardened. He reached inside his robe, took out a folded and sealed parchment, and negligently tossed it at Barret's feet. Then he turned and walked away.
You know, Barret, Khalad said mildly, sometimes you're even more abrasive than Sparhawk himself.
Barret grinned. I know. I'm trying to maintain his reputation. He bent, picked up the parchment, and broke the seal. He removed the identifying lock of hair and quickly read the brief message.
Well?
Khalad asked. Nothing very specific. It says that there's a caravan route running off to the northwest. We are supposed to follow that. We'll get further instructions along the way.
Will it be safe to use the spell and talk with Afriel once we get out of town?
I think so. I'm sure she'd have told me if I wasn't supposed to use it here in Seneska.
We don't have much choice, Khalad said. We can't tell if Sparhawk's already been here, if he's here now, or if he's still on the way, and we've got to let him know about these new instructions.
Do you think we ought to start out tonight?
No, let's not start floundering around in the dark. We might miss the trail, and there's nothing out in that desert but empty.
I won't do anything to put Barret in any kind of danger, Elisun insisted a few days later. I'm very fond of him.
They found out that he was posing as Sparhawk quite some time ago, Elisun, Baroness Melodir told her. You won't be putting him in any more danger than he's already in. Telling Chakol about his disguise will convince her that you've gone over to her side, and that you have access to important information.
You might want to make them believe that your husband's totally smitten with you, Empress Elisun, Patriarch Amban added. Let them think that he tells you everything.
Are you smitten with me, Saravian? Elisun asked archly. Oh, absolutely, my dear. He smiled. I adore you.
What a nice thing to say.
She smiled warmly. Later, children, Melodir told them absently, her forehead furrowed with concentration. At the same time you tell Chakol about Barret's disguise,
drop a few hints about a fleet of church ships in the Gulf of Zakonia. Stragan's been very carefully planting that particular lie, so let's give them some confirmation. After you tell them about Barrett, they'll be inclined to believe your story about the fleet.
She looked at the Emperor.
Is there anything else we can give them that won't hurt us? Something they can verify?
Does it have to be important?
Not really. Just something that's true. We need another truth to get the mix right.
The mix?
It's like a recipe, Your Majesty.
She smiled.
Two parts truth to one part lie. Stir well and serve. If you get the mix right, they'll swallow the whole thing.
They had set out at first light, and the sun had not yet risen when they topped a low ridge and saw a vast, flat expanse of dead whiteness lying ahead. Time, like climate, had lost all meaning.
I'd hate to have to cross that in the summertime, Carlton said.
Truly, Sparhawk agreed.
The slaver's trail swings north here, Vivier noted, probably to go around those flats. If a Seniskan patrol stumbles across us out there, we might have trouble convincing them that we're attached to that caravan we've been following.
We'll just say that we got lost, Carlton said with a shrug. Let me do the talking, Bevier. I get lost all the time anyway, so I can be fairly convincing. How far is it to the other side, Sparhawk?
About 25 leagues, according to my map.
2 days, even if we push,
Carlton calculated.
And no cover, Bevier added. You couldn't hide a spider out...
He broke off.
What's that?
He asked, pointing at an intensely bright spot of light on the mountainous western horizon. Talon squinted at the light.
I think it might be the landmark we've been looking for, he said.
How did you arrive at that? Carlton asked skeptically.
It's in the right direction, isn't it? Ogorajan said that we were supposed to go northwest from Vagayo to the Plains of Salt. Then, he said, from the verge of the Plains of Salt wilt thou behold low on the horizon before thee the dark shapes of the Forbidden Mountains, and if it please Sirgon, his fiery white pillars will guide thee to his hidden city. There are mountains there, and that light's coming from right in the middle of them.
Wouldn't it almost have to be coming from the pillars?
The man was crazy, Talon, Carlton objected.
Maybe, Sparhawk disagreed. But so far, everything he described is right where he said it would be. Let's chance it. It's still the right direction.
About the only thing that might cause us any trouble would be if we stumbled across a helpful Seniskan patrol and they decided to escort us back to that caravan we've been following for the last few days, Mirtai observed. Logically, our chances of coming across a patrol out there on the flats are very slim, Bevier suggested. Seniskans would normally avoid that waste in the first place, and the wars probably pulled almost everybody off patrol duty in the second. And any patrols unlucky enough to cross us won't be making any reports in the third, Mirtai added, her hand on her sword hilt.
We've tentatively located the pillars, Sparhawk said, and if Ogorajan knew what he was talking about, we'll have to take a line of sight on them to penetrate the illusion. Now that we've found them, let's not lose them. We'll just have to take our chances out there on the flats. If we're lucky, nobody will even notice us. If not, we'll try lying to them. And if that doesn't work, we still have our swords.
He looked around at them.
Does anybody have anything else to add?
I think that covers it, Carlton said, still somewhat dubious.
Let's get started then.
They just broke off and ran away, friend Vanyan, Kring said a day or so later. Kring's face was baffled. We were using those tactics Takumi and I came up with, and everything was going more or less the way we expected. And then somebody blew a horn or something, and they turned tail and ran. But where? If what we've been told is true, there's no place in the whole world they can go to catch their breath.
Did you have anybody follow them? Vanyan asked.
I probably should have, I suppose, but I was concentrating on luring the steer guy across the border.
Kling smiled at Sophronia.
That steeric curse doesn't seem to have worn thin in the last 10,000 years, lady.
3 full regiments of Sirgai went down like newly mown wheat when they crossed the border. He paused. They're not really very bright, are they?
The Sirgai? No, it's against their religion.
You'd think that at least a few of them would have realized that something was wrong, but they just kept running across the border and falling over dead.
Independent thinking isn't encouraged among them. They're trained to follow orders, even bad ones.
Kling looked at the bridge crossing the Sarna. You'll be operating from here, friend Vanyan? He asked. I'll put a force on the other side of the bridge, Vanyan replied. But our main camp will be on this side. The river marks the boundary between Tamil proper and Seneska, doesn't it? Technically, I suppose. The Domi shrugged. The curse line's a couple of miles farther west, though.
The boundaries changed several times over the years, Sophronia explained.
Takumi thought I should come up here and talk things over with you, friend Vanyan, Kring said then. We don't want to interfere with Sparhawk, so we haven't been going too far into Seneska. But we're running out of people to chase. How far in have you been going? Vanyan asked. 6 or 7 leagues. Kring replied. We come back to Samar every night, although there's no real reason for it now. I don't think there's any danger of a siege anymore.
No,
Vanyan agreed. We've pushed them enough so that they can't really concentrate on Samar now.
He opened his map and frowned at it for a few moments. Then he dropped to one knee and spread it out on the winter brown grass.
Step on that corner, please, he said to Sophronia. I don't want to have to chase it again.
Kring looked puzzled. Household joke, Sophronia explained, putting one small foot on the corner of Vanyan's map. Vanyan's fond of maps, and an errant breeze turned his current favorite into a kite 2 days ago.
Vanyan let that pass. I'll agree that we don't want to crowd Sparhawk, Domi, but I think we'll want to build some fortified positions out there in the desert. They'll give us jumping-off places when we start our advance on Sirga.
I had the same thought, friend Vanyan.
Let's establish a presence across that border, Vanyan decided. I'll send word to Betwana, and she'll do the same.
How deep in should we go?
Kring asked.
Vanyan looked at Sophronia.
10 leagues? He suggested. That's not so deep that we'll be stepping on Sparhawk's heels, but we'll have room to maneuver. And it'll give you some elbow room for that spell of yours.
Using the spell's a good plan, friend Vanyan, Kring said a bit dubiously. But you're deliberately drawing the best our enemies can throw at us to yourself, and to Lady Sophronia. Is that what you want?
I don't mean to be offensive, but your fight with Quell's soldiers seriously reduced your ranks.
That's one of the reasons I want forts out there in the desert, Domi. Vanyan said wryly.
If worst comes to worst, I'll pull back into those positions. I'm almost sure I can count on some dear friends on my flanks to come to my rescue.
Well said, Sophronia murmured.
Stop, Khalad said sharply, reining in his horse when they were perhaps 5 miles outside Vagayo.
What is it? Barrett asked tensely.
Somebody named Ramshorn died, Khalad said, pointing. I think we should stop and pay our respects.
Barrett looked at the crude grave beside the trail.
I looked right through it, he confessed.
Sorry, Khalad.
Pay attention, my lord.
It seems you've said that before. They dismounted and approached the rude grave.
Clever,
Barrett murmured quietly. It was probably not necessary to lower his voice, but it had gotten to be a habit.
Talon's idea, probably, Khalad said, as they both knelt beside the mound. It's a little subtle for Sparhawk.
Isn't that supposed to be 2 words? Barrett asked, pointing at the weathered plank with ram's horn roughly carved into its face.
You're the educated one, my lord. Don't touch those rocks.
Which rocks?
The yellow ones. We'll mix them up as soon as I read them.
You read rocks? Is that like reading seagulls?
Not exactly. It's a message from Sparhawk. He and my father worked this out a long time ago. The short-bearded young man leaned first this way and then that, squinting at the mound.
"Naturally,"
he said finally, with a certain resignation. He rose and moved to the head of the grave.
"What?" "Sparhawk wrote it upside down. Now it makes sense."
Khalad studied the apparently random placement of the yellowish rocks on the top of the predominantly brown mound.
"Pray, Barrett,"
he said.
"Offer up a prayer for the soul of our departed brother Ramshorn."
"You're not making any sense, Khalad."
"Somebody might be watching. Act religious."
The husky young squire took the reins of their horses and led them several yards away from the ill-defined trail. Then he bent, took Farron's left foreleg in both hands, and carefully inspected the hoof. Farron gave him an unfriendly stare.
"Sorry,"
Khalad apologized to the bad-tempered brute.
"It's nothing important."
He lowered the hoof to the gravel again.
"All right, Barrett,"
he said then.
"Say amen, and we'll get going again."
What was that all about? Barrett's tone was surly as he remounted.
"Sparhawk left a message for us,"
Khalad replied, swinging up into his saddle.
"The arrangement of the yellow rocks told me where to find it."
"Where is it?" Barrett asked eagerly.
"Right now, it's in my left boot. I picked it up when I was checking Farron's hoof."
"I didn't see you pick up a thing."
"You weren't supposed to, my lord."
Craigor awoke with the horrors to the sound of distant screaming. Days and nights had long since blurred in Craigor's awareness, but the sun shattering against his eyes told him that it was full and awful morning. He had certainly not intended to drink so much the previous night, but the knowledge that he was reaching the bottom of his last cask of Archean Red had somehow worried him as he had grown progressively drunker, and the knowledge that it would soon be all gone had somehow translated itself in his fuddled mind into a compulsion to drink it all before it somehow got away from him. Now he was paying for that foolishness. His head was throbbing, his stomach was on fire, and his mouth tasted as if something had crawled in there and died. He was shaking violently, and there were sharp, stabbing pains in his liver. He sat on the edge of his tangled bed with his head in his hands. There was a sense of dread hanging over him, a shadowy feeling of horror. He kept his burning eyes closed and groped under the bed with one shaking hand for the emergency bottle he always kept there. The liquid it contained was neither wine nor beer, but a dreadful concoction of Lamorc origin that was obtained by setting certain inferior wines out in the winter and allowing them to freeze. The liquid that rose to the top and remained unfrozen was almost pure spirits. It tasted foul, and it burned like fire going down, but it put the horrors to sleep. Shuddering, Craigor drank off about a pint of the awful stuff and lurched to his feet. The sun was painfully bright when he stumbled out into the streets of Nathaios and went looking for the source of the screams that had awakened him. He reached a central square and recoiled in horror. Several men were being systematically tortured to death, while Scarpa, dressed in his shabby imitation royal robe and his makeshift crown, sat in an ornate chair watching with approval.
"What's going on?"
Craigor asked Kaba, a shabby Dacite brigand with whom he had frequently gotten drunk. Kaba turned quickly.
"Oh, it's you, Craigor," he said. "As closely as I can gather, the Shining Ones descended on Panamdia."
"That's impossible," Craigor said shortly. "Pataga's dead. There aren't any more of those illusions to keep the Tamils running around in circles."
"If we can believe what some of those dying fellows said, the ones who went into Panamdia weren't illusions," Kaba replied. "A fair number of the officers there got themselves dissolved when they tried to stand and fight."
"What's happening here?"
Craigor asked, pointing at the screaming men bound to poles set up in the middle of the square.
"Scarpa's making examples of the ones who ran away. He's having them cut to pieces. Here comes Sazada."
Kaba pointed at the Styrek, hurrying out of Scarpa's headquarters.
"What are you doing?"
the hollow-eyed Sazada bellowed at the madman sitting on his cheap throne.
"They deserted their posts," Scarpa replied. "They're being punished."
You need every man, you idiot.
I ordered them to march to the north to join my loyal armies. Scarpa shrugged. They concocted lies to excuse their failure to obey. They must be punished. I will have obedience.
You will not kill your own soldiers. Order your butchers to stop.
That's quite impossible, Sazada. An imperial order, once given, cannot be rescinded. I have commanded that every deserter from Panemdia be tortured to death. It's out of my hands now.
You maniac! You won't have a soldier left by tomorrow morning. They'll all desert.
Then I will recruit more and hunt them all down. I will be obeyed. Sazada of Issos controlled his fury with an obvious effort. Klager saw his lips moving and his fingers weaving intricate patterns in the air.
Let's get out of here, Kaba, he said urgently.
What? The crazy man ordered us all to watch.
You don't want to watch what's going to happen next, Klager told him. Sazada's casting a spell, Zemok most likely. He's summoning a demon to teach our emperor the real meaning of the word obedience.
He can't do that. Zalasta left his son in charge here.
No, actually, Sazada's in charge. I personally heard Zalasta tell that spirit who's wriggling his fingers right now to kill Scarpa the minute he stepped out of line. Of course, Sazada might have something else in mind, but either way, it won't be pretty. I don't know about you, my friend, but I'm going to find some place to hide. I've seen the kind of creatures that were subject to Azash before, and I'm feeling a little delicate this morning, so I don't want to see one again.
We'll get into trouble, Krager.
Not if the demon Sazada's summoning right now eats Scarpa alive, we won't.
Krager drew in a deep breath.
It's up to you, Kaba. Stay if you want. But I think I've seen as much as I want to of Natayos.
You're going to desert?
Kaba was aghast.
The situation's changed. If Sparhawk's allied himself with Adelphi, I want to be a long way from here when they come glowing out of that jungle. I find that I'm suddenly homesick for Eosia. Come or stay, Kaba, but I'm leaving. Now.
Chapter 25. Zalasta's face was strangely altered when Akatis unlocked and opened the door to the small, dank cell at the top of the tower. The doubt and remorse which had filled it when he had brought Elana and Aileen to Sirga were gone, and the Styrix's expression was now one of calm detachment. He took in the horrid little room at a glance. Elana and Aileen were chained to the wall, and they were sitting on heaps of moldy straw that were supposed to serve as beds. Crude earthenware bowls, filled with cold gruel, sat untouched on the floor.
This won't do, Akatis, Zalasta said in a remote kind of voice.
It's really none of your concern, the High Priest replied. Prisoners are kept closely confined here in Sirga. As always, Akatis sneered when he spoke to Zalasta.
Not these prisoners.
Zalasta stepped into the cell and took up the chains that bound the two women to the wall. Then, showing no emotion, he crushed them into powdery rust. The situation here has changed, Akatis, he snapped, helping Elana to her feet. Get this mess cleaned up. Akatis drew himself up. I don't take orders from Styrix. I am the High Priest of Sirgon.
I'm truly sorry about this, Your Majesty, Zalasta apologized to Elana. My attention's been diverted for the past week or so.
Evidently, I didn't make my wishes clear to the seer guy. Please excuse me for a moment, and I'll correct that oversight. He turned back to Akatis.
I told you to do something, he said in a dreadful voice. Why haven't you started?
Come out of there, Zalasta, or I'll lock you in with them.
Oh, really? Zalasta said with a thin smile. I thought you had better sense.
I don't have time for this, Akatis. Get this room cleaned up. I have to take our guests to the temple again.
I've received no such instructions. Why should you have?
Sirgon speaks through me.
Precisely. The instructions didn't come from Sirgon.
Sirgon is God here.
Not anymore, he isn't.
Zelasta gave him an almost pitying look.
You didn't even feel it, did you, Akatis? The world heaved and convulsed all around you, and you didn't even notice. How can you possibly be so dense? Sirgon has been supplanted. Klel rules in Sirga now, and I speak for Klel.
That's not possible. You're lying.
Zelasta walked out of the cell and took hold of the front of the High Priest's robe.
Look at me, Akatis, he commanded. Take a long, hard look, and then tell me that I'm lying.
Akatis struggled momentarily, and then, unable to help himself, he looked into Zelasta's eyes.
The blood slowly drained from his face, and then he screamed.
He screamed again, trying to tear himself free from the Styrix's iron grasp.
I beg of you, he cried out in a voice filled with horror. No more! No more!
Then he sagged, covering his eyes with his hands. Zelasta contemptuously let go of the front of his black robe, and he fell to the floor, weeping uncontrollably.
Now do you understand?
Zelasta asked him, almost gently.
Sazada and I tried to warn you and our petty godling about the dangers involved in summoning Klel, but you wouldn't listen.
Sirgon wanted to enslave Belium, and now he's the slave of Belium's opposite. And since I speak for Klel, I guess that makes you my slave.
He prodded the weeping priest with one foot.
Get up, Akatis. Get on your feet when your master speaks.
The groveling priest scrambled to his feet, his tear-streaked face still filled with unspeakable horror.
Say it, Akatis, Zelasta said in a cruel voice. I want to hear you say it. Or would you like to witness the death of another star?
Master,
the High Priest choked. Again, a little louder if you don't mind.
Master!
It came out almost as a shriek.
Much better, Akatis. Now wake up those lazy cretins in the guardroom next door and put them to work cleaning this cell. We have preparations to make when I come back from the temple. Annika's bringing Belium to Sirga, and we'll want to be ready when he arrives.
He turned.
Bring your maid, Elana. Klel wants to look at you.
Zelasta paused, surveying her critically.
I know that we've treated you badly, he half apologized, but don't let our bad manners break your spirit. Remember who you are and draw that about you. Klel respects power and those who wield it.
What do I say to him?
Nothing. He'll find out what he wants to know just by looking at you. He doesn't understand your husband, and seeing you will give him some hints about Annika's nature. Annika's the unknown element in this business. He always has been, I suppose. Klel understands Belium. It's Belium's creature who baffles him.
You've changed, Zelasta.
I suppose I have, he admitted. I have a feeling that I won't live much longer. Klel's touch does peculiar things to people. We'd better not keep him waiting.
He looked at Akatis, who stood trembling violently.
I want this room clean when we come back.
I'll see to it, Master,
Akatis promised in a grotesquely servile tone.
How do you find them again? Itanya asked curiously. What I'm trying to get at is that the trolls are in this no time, but you and Tinian had to come out into real time in order to come into Sarna. So time started moving for you. How do you get back to the moment when you left the trolls?
Please don't ask metaphysical questions, Itanya, Uloth replied with a pained expression. We just go back to the spot where we left the trolls, and there they are. We deal with where, and let the troll gods deal with when. They seem to be able to jump around in time without paying much attention to the rules.
Where are the trolls right now?
Just outside of town, Tinian replied. We didn't think it was a good idea to bring them into Sarna with us,
they're starting to get a little out of hand.
Is it something we should know about, Tinian Knight?
Angessa asked. Ulas leaned back in his chair.
Sirgon disrupted trollish behavior rather profoundly when he went to Thalesia and posed as Gworg, he explained somberly. Zalasta told him about the trolls, but Sirgon's been a little out of touch, so he mistook the trolls for the Dawn Men. The Dawn Men were herd animals, but the trolls sort of run in packs. Herd animals will accept any member of their species, but pack animals are a little more selective. It's to our advantage right now to have the trolls behave like a herd. At least we can keep them all going in the same direction. But some problems are starting to crop up. The packs are beginning to separate, and there's a great deal of snapping and snarling going on.
Tinian glanced at Queen Betwana, who, gowned all in black, was sitting somewhat apart from them. He motioned Angessa slightly to one side.
Is she all right?
He asked very quietly.
Betwana Queen is in ritual mourning,
Angessa replied, also in a half-whisper.
The loss of her husband has touched her very deeply.
Were they really that close?
It did not seem so,
Angessa admitted. His eyes were troubled as he looked at his melancholy queen.
The mourning ritual is seldom observed now. I am keeping careful watch over her. She must not be allowed to do herself injury.
Angessa's shoulder muscles bunched. Tinian was startled.
Is there any real danger of that? It was not uncommon a few centuries ago, Angessa replied.
We'd been expecting you earlier, Itania was saying to Ulas. As I understand it, no time means that the trolls can go from one place to another almost instantaneously.
Not quite instantaneously, Itania. We've been a week or so getting here from the Tommel Mountains. We have to stop and go back into real time every so often so that they can hunt. Hungry trolls aren't the best of traveling companions. So now tell us, what's been happening? We can't make contact with Afriel when we're in no time.
Sparhawks found some clues about the location of Sirga, Itania replied. They aren't too precise, but he's going to try to follow them.
How's Patriarch Bergston coming?
He's captured Sinestra. Had it handed to him on a plate, actually.
Oh?
Do you remember Aetana Meris?
The pretty girl who commanded the garrison in Sinestra? The one who liked you?
Itania smiled. That's the one. She's an abrupt sort of girl, and I'm quite fond of her. And when she saw Bergston and the church knights approaching, she decided to present him with the city. She swept the streets clean of Senescan troops and opened the gates for Bergston. She was going to give him Kimzalua's head as well, but he persuaded her not to.
Pity, Ulas murmured. But that's the sort of thing you have to expect when a good man gets religion.
Vanyan's in place, Itania continued, and he and Kring are establishing strongholds about a day's ride out into Seneska. We're going to do the same here, but we thought we'd wait until you arrived first.
Is anybody encountering any significant opposition? Tinian asked.
It's hard to say exactly, Itania mused. We're moving on central Seneska, but Clell's soldiers pop out of every crack between two rocks. The farther back we push them, the tighter they'll be concentrated. If we don't come up with a way to neutralize them, we'll have to carve our way through them. And from what Vanyan tells me, they don't carve very well. Kring's tactics are working smoothly enough now. But when we get closer to Sirga... He spread his hands helplessly.
We'll work something out, Ulas said. Anything else?
It's all still sort of up in the air, Sir Ulas, Itania replied. The fairy stories Stragan and Kaalador are hatching in Beressa are diverting most of the Senescan cavalry away from the eastern border. Half of them are running south toward the coast around Kaftal, and the other half are running north toward a little village called Jubei. Kaalador added an imaginary massing of the Aetons up there to Stragan's illusory fleet off the southern coast. Between them, they've split the entire Senescan army in two and sent them off to chase moonbeams.
You say that half of them are going north?
Tinian asked innocently.
Toward Jubei, yes. They seem to think the Aetons are massing there for some reason.
What an amazing thing,
Ulaf said with a straight face.
It just so happens that Tinian and I have been sort of drifting in that general direction anyway. Do you think the Seneskans would be too disappointed if they came up against trolls instead of Etons?
You could go up there and ask them, I suppose, Itania replied, also with no hint of a smile.
They all knew what was going to happen at Jubé.
Convey our apologies to them, Ulaf Knight, Petwana said with a sad little smile.
Oh, we will, Your Majesty, Ulaf assured her. If we can find any of them still in one piece after they've frolicked around with the trolls for a couple of hours.
Get out of there,
Carlton shouted, galloping his horse toward the dog-like creatures clustered around something lying on the gravel floor of the desert. The beasts scampered away, hooting with soulless laughter.
Are they dogs? Talon asked in a sick voice.
No, Mirtai replied shortly. Hyenas. Carlton rode back.
It's a man, he reported bleakly. Or what's left of one.
We must bury him, Bevier said.
They'd only dig him up again, Sparhawk told him. Besides, he added, if you start trying to bury them all, we'll be here for several lifetimes.
He gestured at the bone-littered plain stretching off to the low range of black mountains lying to the west. He looked at Zanisha.
It was a mistake to bring you along, Anaray, he apologized. This is going to get worse before it gets any better.
It was not unexpected, Annika, she replied. Carlton looked up at the flock of vultures circling overhead.
Filthy brutes, he muttered.
Sparhawk raised up in his stirrups to peer ahead.
We've got a couple more hours until the sun goes down, but maybe we'd better pull back a mile or two and set up camp a little early. We'll have to spend one night out there. Let's not spend two.
We need those pillars for landmarks anyway, Talon added, and they're a lot brighter when the sun first comes up.
That's if that bright spot we've been following really comes from those pillars, Carlton said dubiously. They got us here, didn't they?
This has to be what Ogorajan called the Plain of Bones, doesn't it? I admit, I had my own doubts right at first. Ogorajan was raving so much of the time that I was sure that he'd garbled at least some of the directions. But he hasn't led us astray yet.
We still haven't seen the city, Talon, Carlton reminded him, so I'd sort of hold off on composing the letter of thanks.
I've got all the money I'll ever need, Ordon, Krager said expansively, leaning back in his chair and looking out through the window at the buildings and the harbor of the port city of Velo.
He took another drink of wine.
I wouldn't go around announcing that, Krager, the burly Ordon advised, particularly not here on the waterfront.
I've hired some bodyguards, Ordon. Can you ask around and find out if there's a fast ship leaving for Zenga in Camoria in the next week or so?
Why would anybody want to go to Zenga?
I grew up there, and I'm homesick, Krager replied with a shrug. Besides, I'd sort of like to grind a few faces. All the people who said that I'd come to no good end while I was growing up.
Did you happen to come across a fellow named Ezek while you were in Nataios? Ordon asked. I think he's a Deeran.
The name rings a bell. I think he was working for the fellow who ran the tavern.
I sent him down there, Ordon explained. Him and the other two, Tal and Shalag. They were going to see if they could join Narstal's band of outlaws.
They may have, but they were working in the tavern when I left.
It's none of my business. But if you were doing so well in Nataios, why did you leave?
Instincts, Ordon, Krager replied owlishly. I get this cold little feeling at the base of my skull, and I know that it's time to run. Have you ever heard of a man named Sparhawk?
You mean Prince Sparhawk? Everybody's heard of him. He's got quite a reputation.
Oh, yes. That he does. Anyway, Sparhawk's been looking for an opportunity to kill me for 20 years or so. And that's the sort of thing that puts a very fine edge on a man's instincts.
Krager took another long drink.
You might want to give some thought to drying out for a while, Ordon advised, looking meaningfully at Krager's tankard of Archean Red.
I run a tavern, and I've learned to recognize the signs. Your liver's starting to go on you, my friend. Your eyeballs are turning yellow.
I'll cut down once I get out to sea.
I think you'll have to do more than just cut down, Krager. You're going to have to give it up entirely if you want to go on living. Believe me, you don't want to die the way most drunkards do. I knew one who screamed for 3 straight weeks before he finally died. It was awful.
There's nothing wrong with my liver, Krager said truculently. It's just a funny light in here. When I get out to sea, I'll space out my drinks. I'll be all right.
His face had a haunted expression, however, and the mere mention of giving up strong drink had set his hands to trembling violently. Warden shrugged. He had tried to warn the man. It's up to you, Krager, he said. I'll ask around and see if I can find a shift that'll get you out of Prince Sparhawk's reach.
Soon, Orden, soon. Krager held out his tankard. In the meantime, why don't we have another?
Ecclesius and his party of Delphae reached Narenja late in the afternoon on a murky day when heavy clouds hung low over the treetops and there was not a breath of air moving. Ecclesius took his boyhood friend Adris and crept forward through the tangle of brush and vines to the edge of the clearing to survey the ruin.
Thinkest thou that they will offer resistance? Adris asked quietly.
That is difficult to predict, Ecclesius replied. Annika and his companions have advised that these rebels are but poorly trained. Methinks their response to our sudden appearance will depend on the character of their officers. Better that we leave them a clear path to the surrounding forest. Should we encircle them, desperation will impel them to fight.
Idris nodded.
They have made some effort to repair the gates, he said, pointing at the entrance to the city.
The gates will pose no problem. I will instruct thee and our companions in the spell which doth modify the curse of Edamus. Those newly made gates are constructed of wood, and wood is as susceptible to decay as is flesh.
He looked up at the dirty gray clouds.
Canst thou make any estimate as to the time of day?
No more than 2 hours until dusk, Adris replied.
Let us proceed, then. We must find yet another gate to provide means of escape for those whom we would confront this night.
And if there be none other?
Then those who would escape must find their own way. I am reluctant to unleash the full force of the curse of Edamus. Should necessity compel me to it, however, I will not shrink from that stern duty. Should they flee, well and good. Should they choose to stay and fight, we will do what we must. I do assure thee, Adris, that when tomorrow's sun rises, none living shall remain within the walls of Narenja.
Good God! Herod exclaimed, peering over the edge of the dry gully at the huge soldiers in close-fitting armor running westward across the sun-baked gravel.
They're monsters!
Keep your voice down, Khalad cautioned. There's no way of knowing how good their ears are.
The strange bestial soldiers were larger than Aton's, and their burnished steel breastplates fit their torsos snugly, outlining each muscle. They wore helmets adorned with fanciful horns or wings, and the visors of those helmets were individualized, evidently forged to fit each warrior's face. They ran westward in a sort of ragged formation, and their hoarse gasping was clearly audible even at this distance.
Where are they going?
Ferret demanded.
The border's off in the other direction.
That one who's trailing along behind the others has a broken-off javelin sticking out of him, Khalad replied. I'd say that means that they've come up against Takumi's Paloi. They've already been to the border, and now they're coming back.
Back to where?
Barrett was baffled.
Where can they go? They can't breathe here.
Khalad cautiously poked his head above the rim of the gully and squinted out across the rocky desert.
They seem to be going toward that cluster of hills about a mile to the west.
He paused.
Just how curious are we feeling today, Barrett?
What have you got in mind?
This gully comes down out of those hills, and if we follow it and keep our heads down, they won't see us. Why don't we drift off toward the west? We might find out something useful if we tag along behind those fellows.
Barrett shrugged. Why not?
That's really not a very logical answer, Barrett. I can think of a half dozen reasons why not.
Khalad squinted at the panting soldiers lurching across the desert.
Let's do it anyway, though.
They slid back down into the gully and led their horses along the dry watercourse toward the west. They moved quietly along the bottom of the wash for about a quarter of an hour. Are they still out there? Barrett whispered.
I'll look.
Khalad carefully climbed back up the steep bank to the rim of the gully and eased his head up far enough to look. Then he slid back down again.
They're still staggering toward the hills, he reported. This gully starts getting shallower up ahead. Let's leave the horses here.
They crept along, crouched over to stay out of sight, and as the gully started to run uphill, they found that they were forced to crawl on their hands and knees. Khalad rose slightly to look again.
They seem to be swinging around behind that other hill, he said quietly. Let's slip up to the top of this ridge and see what's back there.
The two of them crawled out of the now shallow wash and slanted their way up to the ridgeline to a point from which they could see what lay behind the hill Khalad had pointed out. It was a kind of shallow basin, nestled down among the three hills that heaved up out of the surrounding desert. The basin was empty. Where did they go? Barrett whispered.
That basin was the place they were making for, Khalad insisted with a puzzled frown. Wait, here comes that one with the javelin in his belly.
They watched the wounded soldier stumble into the basin, half falling, then rising again to drag himself along. He raised his masked face and bellowed something. Khalad and Barrett waited tensely. Then two other soldiers emerged from a narrow opening in the side of one of the hills, descended to the floor of the basin, and half dragged their injured comrade back up the hill and through the mouth of the cave.
That answers that, Khalad said. They ran across miles of open desert to get to that cave.
Why? What good will it do them?
I haven't got a clue, Barrett, but I think it's important.
Khalad stood up.
Let's go back to where we left the horses. We can still cover a few more miles before the sun goes down.
Eucrasius crouched at the edge of the forest, waiting for the torches inside the walls of Narenja to burn down and for the sounds of human activity to subside. The events at Panandia had confirmed the assessment of these rebels Lord Banyan had given him at Sarna. Given the slightest opportunity, these poorly trained soldiers would flee, and that suited Eucrasius very well. He was still somewhat reluctant to unleash the curse of Edamus, and people who ran away did not have to be destroyed. Idris returned, ghosting back to the edge of the jungle through the night mist. All is in readiness, Eucrasius, he reported quietly. The gates will crumble at the merest touch. Let us then proceed, Eucrasius replied, standing up and relaxing the rigid control that dimmed his inner light. Let us pray that all within yon walls may flee, and if they do not, then they must surely die. Our promise to Annika binds us. We will empty yon ruin, in one fashion or the other.
It's not so bad here, Carlton said as they dismounted. The bones are older, for one thing.
Necessity had compelled them to camp in the hideous boneyard the previous night, and they were all eager to reach the end of the horror. Sparhawk grunted, looking across the intervening stretch of desert at the fractured basalt cliff that seemed to mark the eastern edge of the Forbidden Mountains. The sun had just come up above the eastern horizon, and its brilliant light reflected back from the pair of quartz-laced peaks rearing up out of the rusty black mountains just to the west. End of Side 9. To continue, turn the cassette over.